Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. That means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those with those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas, no desire to be in bed next to someone, if you know what I mean. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in the reviews. There are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code, which is the acronym of the podcast, TSNOTYAW, at checkout. That's the podcast acronym at checkout at happymammoth.com.
Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which six amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamaray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
Welcome everyone to another Books with Hooks. We do not have our fearless leader Bianca here today, so it's just me, Cece, and of course, Carly. So today you're just going to have to make do with the two of us. Carly, will you read us that first query letter?
I will. So we have a really fun query letter today, which is some of you guys who listen to the show very regularly, and we know many of you actually listen every week, and we're so thankful. So this is actually going to be a repeat query letter. So somebody kind of went off, as you'll see as I read the query letter, and coming back to us. And I'm really excited about the revisions they made. Okay, so let's get into it. Dear Carly, Cece, and Bianca, I'm reaching out because you provided helpful feedback on my query and pages during your 17th of August episode. An agent, Redacted, reached out to me after the episode aired, wanting to read more. She suggested I revise and resubmit based on the feedback provided to me from Carly and subsequently from this agent. I wanted to resubmit my pages to the podcast in hopes you'll critique the changes I made. I have attached both my previous and revised query and pages. Thank you so much for this opportunity. My new query is shorter, minus this paragraph, and clocks in at 397. Okay, let's get into the query letter. My 81,000 word dual point of view romance, The Summer We Started Living, will appeal to readers who enjoyed the summer vibes and second chance romances found in Carly Fortune's Meet Me at the Lake and Annabelle Monaghan's Same Time Next Year. Penny has spent the last 12 years hiding from her past, content to run the children's activities division of Maple Fox, a family camp in rural Vermont. She lives with a tight-knit group of coworkers, and her life is stable and predictable, all the things her childhood wasn't. But Penny learns the camp will be sold at the end of the summer, leaving her with no job and nowhere to live. Cherry on top, George, the guy who broke her heart in high school, shows up at the camp with his kids for a two-week vacation. Recently divorced, George arrives at Maple Fox with two goals: to repair his fractured relationship with his four kids, and to prove to everyone he's not the workaholic they think he is. But those goals are in jeopardy when a work crisis forces George to pay more attention to his phone than his kids. He also discovers that Penny, his high school love he thought he'd never see again, works at the camp and she's able to connect with his kids in a way that eludes him. Despite Penny's steadfast adherence to her camp's professional code to not fraternize with campers, old feelings reignite when George reveals the truth about what really happened the night they last saw each other. Sparks fly as they sing over s'mores, laugh through game nights, and hunker down during a power outage. Penny and George each begin to realize how stagnant their lives have become since high school. George is ready to remedy his past mistakes with Penny by his side, but Penny isn't so sure. She fears that getting involved with George will only lead her back to the past she escaped. As competing job and family-related pressures mount, they must decide whether the bond they've recreated at camp is worth trying to replicate in the real world, or if they'll both walk away brokenhearted once again. I'm a behavior analyst and wife, mom to three redheads and an elderly beagle. In my spare time, you can find me writing, reading, or liberally adding garlic to everything I cook. Kirsten Murkowski.
Thank you, Carly. So what did you think of the query letter?
This is so much better. So much better, Kristen. I can't even tell you how much better this is. And it makes me so happy because sometimes I feel like I'm just talking into my microphone and I'm like, does anybody actually listen to me? Like, tap, tap, is this thing on? Like, you know, but yeah, I'm so glad you guys actually do listen to me because this is so much better. So the title was great. So same title. It's a bit longer. I noticed that because I'm comparing what you sent last time. The comps. Oh my gosh. So much better. Last time you comped Dirty Dancing meets The Sound of Music, which two things that I love. Meet Me at the Lake same time next year. Way, way, way better comps. So I can't even tell you how much better I think this is. The only thing that kind of stands out to me still in the revision is the whole, like, her life is stable and predictable bit. I really like bristle a little bit whenever query letters are like, this character's life was normal. And I know it's a very common way to kind of suggest that your character's life is changing. I don't know. For some reason, I don't know why this always kind of like flags up in me to be like, oh, why is this sounding boring? Because I know it's not boring. I always want to focus on what is more the most excitable. So I'm wondering if we can just reframe that to say, instead of the end of the sentence saying all the things her childhood wasn't, I'm wondering if we could center the fact that her childhood wasn't calm, and you know what I mean? Just to like show from the beginning, and that is the interesting piece here, as opposed to just be like, her life is stable and predictable. That's really the main note here. I mean, the only other note I had, because this is well done, I'm so glad of all the changes you made. The only other note I had was just, we still don't really know that much about her past, right? Because she says like that her childhood wasn't stable and predictable. And then we know that she wants to escape the past, but she's presumably kind of in her 30s now or late 20s, because it says she spent the last 12 years hiding from her past. The last time, you know, she saw George, she was in high school. So we can kind of assume she's in her 30s. I'm like, what has she been doing the last 10 years other than working at this farm, which is great, fine, that's a job, that's awesome, you know, that's a life for sure. But from a reader's perspective, I'm like, well, what has she been doing and what is she running from specific? But you know, those are curiosity inducing moments. So yeah, I just want to say well done. I'm just really glad to see all these improvements, and I think you did a great job. Cece, what do you think?
I love the fact that an agent reached out to her after we read the query letter. Agents, you're welcome. We're all very lovely here. You know, you're welcome. We're doing all this amazing work for you. It's just really cool. It's really cool to see that happening. It makes me feel inspired and energized. It is just really, really awesome. I adore the inciting incident. I think it's perfect for the genre. Meet Me at the Lake. I was lucky enough to read that as an arc. Lucky enough to interview Carly Fortune. It seems like a really great comp here because it is such a like a juicy book. Like, it's sweet and heartwarming and cute, all things that a rom-com needs to be, but it's also juicy, right? And that's what makes it such a compelling, addicting read. And that's the genius of Carly Fortune. So I'm very excited with the inciting incident. I think you did a great job. My thing, and this is very much a me problem, a me thing, a CC specific thing. So you are free to disregard. When I read a major dramatic question such as yours, I wonder if it's enough. And I'll read that here for our listeners. They must decide whether the bond they've recreated at camp is worth trying to replicate in the real world, or if they'll both walk away brokenhearted once again. It's tough. It is tough, again, for me, for my taste, for me to get behind spending, you know, hours and hours and hours with two characters who are both single and available and into each other, because I'm like, what's standing in their way, you know? And I know you've mentioned that there's a heartbreak in the past. I know you've mentioned that, you know, obviously if they were to get together, they would have to face things like dealing with a family, a blended family potentially, right? So I know these things, but I don't know, we're still talking about two people who like just get together people, you know? So I don't know. We'll talk more about this on the pages, but I think it's good. I just really wish the major dramatic question were juicier. Because in my opinion, the rom-coms that really, really stand out, they are all those lovely, adorable things, but they also have the juiciness element to it. So yeah, with that, Carly, will you summarize what happens in the opening pages, please?
All right. So this, again, might be familiar to you guys. So I will kick us off. So we start with chapter one and Penny's point of view 5 days before opening day is kind of what is told to us at the top. So we are with Penny. Penny is kind of getting everything organized to kick off the year at Maple Fox. They're kind of looking through the roster of people and families that are going to come spend time with them that year. She sees George Watt's name on the roster and is all just like, oh my gosh, is it him? Da 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 da. And then everybody that works there is also talking about George because it's like a single dad, not married, 4 kids. They're all just like, huh, no partner for him. Da 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 da. Kind of just, you know, so like, oh, he's separated. And she's like, her heart's racing kind of as she's like, okay, we're talking about him. And she's trying to put all those feelings aside. Then a couple, maybe 1 or 2 pages later, we find out that the owners of the camp are actually selling the camp. And so that's obviously a really big deal for her and kind of wrapping her head around that. And yeah, that's where we end.
Thank you, Carly. And what did you think of the execution?
All right. So I think this first page is, again, so much better. I went back and compared the last page, the, you know, first submission to this submission. So I'll read you the old first line and I'm going to read you guys the new first line. So the old first line says, even though she'd known the announcement was coming, nothing could have prepared Penny for the way her heart slammed against her chest when she heard the words spoken out. Earl and I have some news. And so that's introducing the fact that the place is being sold. The new first line is, Penny had an excellent poker face. I think this is a much, much, much better line. And then we kind of get into, you know, the George Watt stuff. So instead of centering in the old manuscript, centering the selling of the lodge or the camp, the new one is centering George. So I think this is a really, really good choice to do that. You know, I love the banter between all of the employees kind of talking about George. I thought that was really great. And even though we're doubling down on the fact of like they're selling the lodge and like there's, you know, George is coming, it felt like natural to me, which is just really, really well done because it could feel really coincidental that you're trying to, you know, slam on these two major kind of inciting incidents or plot points or big, big moments. So I thought you did a really great job in that being natural. One thing I wanted to note is I think I was saying earlier in the query critique, I didn't know how old she was, but at the end of these pages, actually find out that she is turning 30. So there we are. She is turning 30. Cece, what did you think of the pages?
I thought they were really polished and super well written. I can tell like the level of care that went into this and I really appreciate it. And the setup is excellent. Storytelling is about change and these pages promise a lot of change to come. Selling of the camp, her reuniting with George, right? And that excites the reader. That makes the reader want to turn the pages. And so it's really, really excellent. I do think that I needed more on why she's keeping a poker face with her colleagues. I get that it's a habit. I get that it's something she's internalized. But I would like a little bit more emotionality and a little bit more interiority with the story forward juiciness about why that is. I also kind of would have preferred it if she walked into a room and they were all arguing and then they stopped talking when they saw her. And then they kind of made it about her birthday that they're celebrating early because of the craziness that happens with the camp later on. And then she kind of found out, and then for a moment she thinks, oh, that's why they stopped talking, you know, because they wanted to surprise me with this early birthday cake. But then she finds out that it's actually because of the sale. Like, I would have liked that to unfold in a way that just leveraged more the fact that she was kept as an outsider, because I think that would have made us root for her even more. And that would have made us more curious about why they're so protective of her. And to me, the reason would be clear, which is the fact that this is her life. You know, probably everyone there has a life outside of work. But she doesn't. Like, this is her entire life. And so she probably would have felt a lot of mixed feelings about, you know, being infantilized, being protected. And probably that would have triggered a lot of complicated, messy emotions for her. Because given what I am expecting of her childhood, she has wanted to be protected all her life. And so being protected now as an adult would probably be very confusing to her because she would feel like, well, no, I'm a grown-up now. I don't need this. But at the same time, she's been craving it. So anyway, lots to unpack there. And I like that. And I also think it would have just made for more surprise in terms of the reveal of the sale because the reader would have been like, oh, it's just about the birthday. So I would have framed a little bit differently. I also think that on a micro level, I noticed a few missed opportunities to center things around her. So one of the things I'm always looking for in any book, really, but especially in the beginning, is are you making the protagonist, your protagonist, the son of the story? Everything should revolve around them. Everything should be centered on them. If you have multiple protagonists, it depends on whose POV we're in at that time. But here's an example. The two married camp owners are talking to each other, and there's a line that reads, "Though the two had been married for 40 years and camp co-owners for the past 30 of them, they still affectionately refer to each other as chef and boss as a nod to their roles at camp." And that's it. And we go back to dialogue. As you can see, that is purely explanation. The only purpose of these sentences is to explain to the reader that these two people have been married for 40 years, that they're co-owners of the camp for the past 30, and that they affectionately refer to each other as chef and boss because that's what they are in the camp. And that is adorable. But you could take this further, in my opinion. Instead of keeping the line as is, which honestly kind of feels a little info dumpy, infuse emotion. One example of an emotion that probably won't work, but maybe she wants that kind of love. She wants the 30 plus year partnership, 40 plus year partnership, but she thinks it's not in the cards for her. Maybe she looks at that kind of relationship as something that kind of like, you know, I don't know how I look at mountain climbing. Like, I think it's so awesome. I would love theoretically to do it, but I will never be capable of doing it because it's me. I don't have the upper body strength or the anything to mountain climb. So I don't know. I think that one of the things that you should do as a storyteller is look at every single bit of information that your story has, highlight it, and think of how you can tether that into her unique perspective, her unique vision of the world that will reveal her character while you're also revealing information about the story. So we'll learn about the marriage, we'll learn about the decades partnership, and we'll learn about her. And that is your job. Your job is to make us connect with her. So that is my micro note for you. I really liked this. I thought you did a really great job, and I hope that you get lots of bites.
Any agents listening to this, you're going to want to request. We're huge fans, so well done. Okay, Cece, can you kick off your query for today?
Let's do this. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, I discovered the shit no one tells you about writing as I was devouring resources on craft during lockdown. If I recall correctly, Carly and Cece were introduced as special guests and have been a devotee ever since. It's the first podcast I share whenever I meet someone who wants to write a book. Thank you so much for providing the writing community with such a wonderful resource. Dear agent, personalization goes here. Fans of Margaret Rogerson's Sorcery of Thorns and crossover fans of Rachel Gillig's One Dark Window will be drawn to the hidden identities, lost magic, political scheming, unlikely friendships, and romantic elements in Redacted, YA fantasy, 104,000 words. Within every powerful institution, darkness slumbers. Do not wake it. The idea that any 18-year-old should know what they want to do with their lives, let alone make an irrevocable career choice at their selection ceremony, frustrates Neva Cairn. She certainly doesn't want to work at the Temple of Justice like the rest of her family. She hates politics. A visit to an off-limits district of the city with her big sister is the small act of rebellion she needs, until it isn't. She barely makes it home after run-ins with strange cults, leather-bound barbarians, and knife-wielding muggers. When Neva's selection is inexplicably moved up and she's ordered to move into the temple to serve as a clerk, she believes someone from that unsanctioned trip must be to blame. Her father refuses to help, insisting the position is an honor, and abandoning it would ruin the family. At the temple, she's faced with hostile peers and meaningless work. Worse, no one will acknowledge the threatening notes, break-ins, or deaths on temple grounds. Her growing feelings for the boy with the enchanting green eyes is a complication she doesn't want to think about. Neva hunts for answers and a way out of the assignment without harming her family. She's willing to do just about anything, even if it means agreeing to participate in the shady political deals she despises. After surviving an encounter with a murderous shadow monster prowling the halls at night, Neva struggles to come to terms with the revelation that the old stories are true, and what saved her from the monster also makes her the biggest target. I live in southwest Idaho with my husband, daughters, and Pompag Winchester. My daylight hours are spent working in hospital administration, but I prefer traveling with my family, writing, sewing, and devouring podcasts and books. My short story, After Stars Falls, was included in the 2023 anthology, The Sun Still Rises. I hold a BA in theater directing and acting and an MAT from Fuller, where I continued my academic exploration of how stories we engage are formative. Thank you for your time and consideration of my work. Name redacted.
Thank you so much, Cece. And tell us how long it is and what you thought of this pitch.
So the writer included the word count. Thank you for that. 398 words. Yes. Okay. So, and this does not count the first paragraph, by the way, which is clearly something meant for us. Firstly, it is so sweet that you've been listening for this long. I do remember when Carly and I were special guests on the podcast. We didn't even think about like the idea of being co-hosts. It sounded trippy to me, and I'm sure to her as well. So this is so cool. It's such a cool trip down memory lane to think about it. Since you, name redacted writer person, are a longtime fan, you should know that you should italicize your titles or write them in all caps. And you didn't hear, so I'm going to call you out on that. Maybe it was a formatting issue, but like, just so you know, when you send this out, please italicize or write your titles in all caps. I personally prefer all caps, but you know, either works, I suppose. Let's talk about plot paragraphs, because that is what I obsess with. She's ordered to move into the temple to serve as clerk. But above, we get a mention saying that she's supposed to choose her path. So I was confused, like, is it an assignment? Is it a choice? Like, what is it actually? Was she the only one who was assigned? Is she meant to keep the fact that it was an assignment versus a choice a secret? That gave me a little bit of pause. And then the last two lines of the second plot paragraph that starts with worse, no one will acknowledge the threatening notes. And then we have another line that reads her growing feelings for the boys. Those two lines don't feel connected. So ideally, in a query letter, you have a plot that feels like dominoes tipping over. One thing leads to this other thing, which leads to this other thing. And that causality, that really matters. It gives the reader the impression that you're reading this inevitable story that is so organic. Of course it's not. Of course it's pure manipulation on the storyteller's part, but it doesn't feel like manipulation. And that's really, really important. And right now I'm like, what does this boy have to do with the story? Where is he coming from? It just feels like satellites orbiting a plot as opposed to a dominoes tipping over situation, which I really wanted. I also did not understand how the old stories, like what they mean, how their truth has anything to do with this. And I'm wondering whether we need that. Maybe we don't. But also when you say that the fact that she saved her from the monster makes her the biggest target of what? Like of the monster again? Of something else? I guess all my notes about plot is my way of saying, like, this is a super inventive and fun premise, and I love that, but I don't think it's packaged in a way that makes the story feel like it is one intentional thing. And I think it's because you're mentioning various aspects of your story and not quite connecting them. So that would be my note for you. It would be to urge you to find a way to tether it all together and to connect it all together so that it feels more like a web, something that's very connected and interconnected. And I think that would make it read a little bit stronger. What did you think, Carly?
All right. So, you know, I have really mixed feelings about a tagline because like when they don't work, they don't work. But this tagline actually works really well. It's a very kind of specific UK style of thing. So the tagline here is within every powerful institution, comma, darkness slumbers, period, do not wake it. And so taglines are those things that you sometimes see on the front cover of a book, kind of in that like, you know, bold writing, and it was separated obviously from the title and the author's name, or sometimes it goes on the back of the jacket, kind of like up at the top to kind of frame the jacket copy. So they're different than a pitch, and loglines are used more commonly in TV, film. In the UK, they use these a lot on jackets and things like that. So anyway, I really like that logline. I thought it was good. Okay, so in terms of the... Well, I mean, I guess I should preface this as I always do, which is, you know, I don't do a lot of science fiction fantasy. So it's, you know, as you guys know, it's not my area of expertise, but I'll do my very best to critique this pitch as I would anything else. So in terms of the selection ceremony, so this is a very kind of common trope for this category, which makes me think that we really have to emphasize how your selection ceremony is different than other selection ceremonies and that type of kind of trope that happens in this category. That's something I would really just want to make sure you're highlighting off the top. The next thing I will say is I love a time crunch. So I love when you say the selection is inexplicably moved up. Love that. Love when we kind of like have a time limit and we have to reduce it. And obviously, you know, as I said, love that time crunch. So overall, you know, as with anything with SFF, there's just a lot of plot packed into this. And we kind of have to figure out what do we need to know right now to hook us. And something that you said here, which is at the temple, she's faced with hostile peers and meaningless work. Meaningless is one of these words that sounds boring because, you know, we're like, oh, okay, what, you know, why are we focusing on meaningless work Is there another word we can choose that suggests potentially the same thing? Maybe you can focus on the fact that, you know, she's very ambitious and these tasks aren't meeting her ambitious standards. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, there's another way to frame meaningless that doesn't sound boring, because I think boring is the death knell of a query letter. So I would really try to highlight how we can improve on that. So next, I kind of want to talk about, like, who is she protecting in all of this? And it seems like the family, which is a strong motivator, you know, for a child. This is a YA book. And so obviously protecting your family is very important. But I also am just very curious about, like, herself, right? It says she wants to hunt for answers and a way out of the assignment without harming her family. She's willing to do just about anything, even if it means agreeing to participate in the shady political deals she despises. I'm like, why would she do that? Who is she protecting? How does this serve herself? Or why is she kind of willing to go to these lengths for her family? And this is what makes SFF queries so hard. And they make my, like, brain rattle in its cage, because there's so much information to jam in. And I know that we don't have a lot of space to do it. So it really just requires, like, really, really getting that, like, tunnel vision on what does this agent need to know to request these pages, which is, like, the question you should always be coming back to here. Because ultimately, you want to focus on the plot, but I also need to know your world. And so if I'm not clear on the world itself, sometimes I don't know how big the stakes are. For example, she says, after surviving an encounter with a murderous shadow monster prowling the halls at night, Nevaeh struggles to come to terms with the revelation that the old stories are true. And what saved her from the monster also makes her the biggest target. So because I have no idea what this kind of world looks and feels like yet, I have a really hard time getting invested in the murderous shadow monster or the stakes of the monster itself, because earlier on, we're just mostly talking about the selection ceremony. So this is why I struggle. This is why I'm like, I always feel bad critiquing SFF pitches, because I want you guys to get, you know, the best critique from somebody that was in the space. So it's always on my list when we're having guest speakers to get more SFF agents. And so that's on my to-do list for the rest of the year for you guys. All right, Cece, what is happening in these opening pages?
So we have our protagonist walking into the apothecary shop, and we know from interiority that her mother does not want her there. But she's there anyway, and she's thinking of the selection appointment, which is going to be in 2 weeks. And she's thinking of what her life would be like if she does choose to, you know, go down the apothecary path. And she's kind of talking to her mom in her head, you know, struggling and thinking that she doesn't want to work at the temple. And she's waiting, which is unusual, for Master Sharp. And instead of Master Sharp, she sees this boy who's there, and he's really cute. And, you know, she's like, what, like, where did he come from? And she assumes that he's just at the shop like she is as a customer. But then through banter and teasing, she realizes that he is the apprentice, meaning that it's too late for her to choose to be Master Sharp's apprentice. And that ends the first chapter. And we have the beginning of the second chapter, which picks up right where we left off. And she wanted to kick herself for assuming that Master Sharp, like, wanted her. And she is still thinking he's really cute, but she's now annoyed with him. And she's thinking about how apprenticing at a different shop just won't be the same. And she tells him when they start talking that she plans to declare apothecary when the time comes for her selection ceremony. And yeah, that's where we stop.
All right. Thank you, Cece. And what did you think about these pages?
Okay, so I like that there's a disruption. I think that that's something I'm always looking for in the opening pages. She walks in with a very clear goal, and, you know, the presence of this boy is confusing. And then there's a very clear disruption, which is the fact that she is too late. So I like that. I would, however, suggest that you dial it up even more. So right now they're hanging at the shop together. And when she realizes, oh, he's the apprentice. I would have preferred her to be a bit more bold so that she could come crashing down even more, which sounds really mean. I'm talking about a character here. So imagine, for example, that in that first scene, because she's so at home at the apothecary shop and she assumes he's a customer, she starts going behind the counter and doing things that are very, like, ownership-like, you know, like she belongs in that space. And the boy kind of indulges her a little bit. And then when she realizes that, oh no, he is the apprentice and he's the one who's supposed to be behind the counter and he's the one who's supposed to be, like, helping her, then that would feel really embarrassing, right? And having a character feel embarrassed like that is a great way to make us root for her, to make us feel for her. And it would also go a long way towards their chemistry. So right now, when she first sees him and thinks he's really cute, I'll be honest, it was framed in a way that was placid. You know, it's not bad, but it was placid. Why? Because there's no power imbalance. But if there's power imbalance, it's easier to create chemistry. It's easier to create really any emotion with power imbalance. And so I think that, you know, once she discovers that he is the apprentice, and she had already mentioned that she was Master Sharp's apprentice in this situation that I'm proposing, that would have been so embarrassing that that would have really messed the chemistry that they share between them, because she would have been really torn between how cute he is and the fact that she just embarrassed herself, et cetera, et cetera. So I would just dial it up. I'm not suggesting you really change anything. Like, I'm suggesting you just dial it up even more, because the elements are strong. And I think that there's a lot of potential here with the kind of disruption that you have set up and the chemistry between these two and just her general, the fact that she's there against her mother's wishes. There's a lot of setup that's working really well. I did wonder why she mentioned that she was planning to declare apothecary afterwards, right? Like, it felt like, why would she show her cards? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. If she had shown her cards before she knew who he was, that would have made sense. And then also, and this might be, like, I want to preface this by saying that I don't read a lot of YA, and so maybe this is just me being wrong, but I thought there were a lot of italics here, a lot of direct thoughts in italics, and it felt jarring and it felt distracting. I don't think you need as many. I'd tone it down. But yeah, overall, really exciting beginning, really exciting setup, lots of tension or potential for tension. And I really like that there's a countdown in the beginning too, like 40 days until Unity Festival. Like, I'm always on the lookout for things like that. So yeah, I thought it was really exciting. What did you think, Carly?
I agree. I love a countdown. I love a time crunch, all my favorite things. So the first page, I really liked it because it set the scene for how things are kind of like working in the universe without doing a lot of telling. Like, for example, she explains, you know, it was unusual for the apothecary to leave customers waiting unacknowledged. The uncommon quiet allowed the gentle slosh of the water wheel in the back room to be heard. It powered, among other things. And then it kind of just like talks a bit about the world, right? The slow turning ceiling fan circulating warm air from the corner stove to the drying racks around it. She could name almost every herb, flower, and plant hanging there. Lemon balm, white sage wafted down to her on the gentle stir of air. I think this does a lot of important things. Number one, it tells us what is usual and unusual about the situation. It explains to us that the water wheel powers things. It tells us what she pays attention to, and so we can get into the herbs and things like that. So I thought this was really well done. And I think there is a lot of kind of a mix of curiosity. I will say, though, the selection ceremony thing sounds very familiar, as I said earlier, just because, you know, this is something that is common in SFF and fantasy novels. So what I always think is interesting when somebody uses a trope is, how are they going to use it? Are they going to subvert it? Are they going to use it head on? And if we're using it head on, which we kind of seem to be doing in this case, it is the familiar piece of this unfamiliar world. And so that's why I'm like, okay, let's kind of amp up what is unusual, either about the selection ceremony or about her world, so that we have that mix of like familiarity, but unfamiliarity, which I think is one of the things that people love about discovering new worlds in SFF worlds, which can be really, really important. Something I found really interesting was that when you wrote, you know, talking about the boy, the teen, the young man in the book, she said, I've never seen someone who made her knees weak. I thought that only happens in romance novels. I thought that was really interesting. I'm like, in her world, there's romance novels? Like, you know, I don't know if that was like wink, wink, nod, nod, just to like, you know, this is a book type of thing. But that surprised me a little bit. And, you know, I just thought it was kind of cute. I really like that the chapters are short. I think this is very, very well done. I think that's just right on point for your readership. So I really like that. I like that we were just really getting into the characters, you know, not overdoing it with kind of setting and world building too early on. Yeah, those are my notes. This is a fun story.
Thank you so much, Carly. All right, that's it for today's Books with Hooks. Now let's go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
I'm Chelsea Devantes, and I wrote a comedy gal memoir. It is titled I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, but I'm going to anyway. And it is out on June 4th. I have partnered with the indie bookstore, The Purple Couch Bookshop, who I recently met, and I just love them so much. And I've also partnered with the podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, to give away 15 personalized copies of my memoir to listeners who enter the giveaway. And here's the thing. I always wanted to know about jobs, about writing, how people got into entertainment. And so when I wrote my memoir, I included all those details. I listened to podcasts like The Shit No One Tells You About Writing all the time when I was coming up, trying to learn, glean, get details, get the dirt, get the goss. I included all of the goss. It is my life. It has wild twists and turns. Listen, I date a magician. I find out my dad is not my dad. I go on to become Jon Stewart's head writer. There's all kinds of things in there, and I put a lot of deets in. So I'm looking forward to being a speaker at the All About Memoir webinar on the 11th of May, where I will be talking more about the book and more about how to memoir, because I read memoirs all the time. I host a podcast called Glamorous Trash, where all we do is cover memoirs, specifically female celebrity memoirs. So enter the giveaway to win a copy of my book, and I will see you at the workshop.
Today's guest is the award-winning author of 12 novels, including the New York Times bestseller Pictures of You and Is This Tomorrow? A book critic for People magazine, her essays, articles, and stories have been included in New York Magazine, the Modern Love column in the New York Times, Salon, and the Daily Beast, among other publications. The recipient of a New York Foundation of the Arts Award for Fiction and a Sundance Screenwriters Lab finalist, she is also the co-founder of A Mighty Blaze. It's my pleasure to welcome Caroline Levitt. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bianca. I'm so thrilled to be here.
I'm so thrilled to have you here, and there's a lot we're going to need to break down in half an hour. But first, I am obsessed with literary citizenship. I'm obsessed with being a good literary citizen and being there for other writers and giving them a community, because writing is such a lonely endeavor. So please, can we break down A Mighty Blaze for our listeners who may not have heard of it?
Sure. Mighty Blaze started on the day of the pandemic when my publisher called me up and said that my whole book tour for my last book, With or Without You, was canceled. And I said, but I'm due to fly out to Texas that day. And they said, no, everything's locked down. The bookstores are locking down. It's over. So when I got off the phone, I thought, nothing is over. I have to do something about this. So I made a little video of myself giving the speech I had prepared, complete with hand motions and everything else. And I sent it to Algonquin, my publisher, and they said, oh, this is really great. We're going to send it to the libraries. And I thought, you know what? I bet I can help my friends. So I put something up on Facebook saying, you know what? My tour was canceled and I'm not taking this sitting down. So for all you writers out there whose tours are canceled, you know what? Make me a little video, like no more than 1 or 2 minutes. The only requirements are you have to call out another writer. You have to call out another author and you have to mention your favorite indie bookstore. And I'll post them up. I'll post them all over social media. I thought I would get like, you know, maybe like 10. Within 2 days, I had 200. And I was spending, you know, the beginning of the pandemic just putting these videos up and telling people and getting crazy. And the media heard of it. And I got a call from the Washington Post saying, Caroline, what are you doing? This is so great. I said, I have no idea. So it just got busier and busier. And then this other writer, Jenna Blum, called me up and said, do you need help? And I said, I absolutely do. I have no idea what I'm doing. And I'm not, I've never run anything before. I'm an introvert. I don't know how to do this. So she came on and together we started talking about what we wanted to do. And we decided we were going to make a company where we would interview authors and maybe we could get support from other places. So we started reaching out and to my absolute surprise, we got the Washington Post, the New York Times to support us, poets and writers, Publishers Weekly, The Guardian, all these people started coming. And Jenna said, you know what? We should hit up really big authors and ask them if they'll come on and be interviewed. And I said, okay, like we can do that. So to my absolute surprise, everybody wanted to help. Everybody wanted to help. We got John Irving, we got Judy Collins, we got Anne Lamont, we got George Saunders, we got everybody wanted to do it and nobody was asking for any money. And it just kept growing and growing and growing. We're now on our fourth year. We have, I think we have now 35 passionate and brilliant volunteers. We have about 7 different programs. And the wonderful thing about it is that everybody at the Blaze, we're all really a family. We all really like take care of each other and support each other. And we have this whole community now, and it's this amazing thing. And it's been really important to me to give back to the literary community that has done so much for me, and also to help writers, because I know how hard it is. You know, for every writer who gets a debut for published for 6 figures and does phenomenal, there are at least like 50 other fabulous writers who are sort of struggling or scraping by. And that's why I always help. I always help because I feel like, you know, if you don't help other writers, then there's a place in the 9th circle of hell for you. Because it doesn't take much to, you know, sometimes all you have to do is just mention another author's book on your social media or, you know, give a blurb or, you know, go to a reading. It's just a really great feeling to be a part of the community, and to be able to help is wonderful.
I agree 100%. And I think this is why at the moment I'm feeling a bit shocked and disappointed, because on Twitter, on Threads, we're seeing a lot of, I don't know if it's younger writers or inexperienced writers who are using these platforms to take down other writers.
That's terrible.
To say awful things about their work, to diminish their work and to belittle them. And I'm just, from a human level, it's awful.
Like, it's terrible.
Why do we do this to other human beings? It's terrible. But two, this is such a difficult industry and it's a small industry. And, you know, I don't always love books. Taste is subjective. I might read a book and be like, it's not really for me. But then I keep quiet about it, right? I don't go on social media and trash some author because I know how difficult it is to write a book. So this wave is, I don't know, it's freaking me out.
Yeah, me too, actually. I won't review a book if I don't like it, because I feel like maybe the book's just like you. Maybe the book's just not for me. Or like, why trash another author? And I think what the important thing to realize is that the people who do that, this is more about them than the writer. I mean, I had a friend who wrote a wonderful, wonderful, amazing book that I just loved. And she was skewered in a major newspaper by a major writer. And the odd thing was that after the dust settled, because that review was so nasty, she actually sold more books than ever. Because people reading the review, people know. I mean, people see something nasty and they think, what got into that person? Why would they do that? And, you know, they said, I'm going to give this book a try. You know, the book went on to do very, very well. So
karmic justice. Yeah, I saw recently that somebody's book was skewered and the reviewer said something like, does this person's husband even love them? And this was like in the New York Times or something. And I was like, oh my God, you know, one, how have we gotten here as human beings that we say these kinds of things? Two, how have they been allowed to publish this awful takedown? Because that feels very personal as opposed to about the work.
Yes, it is very, it does become very personal. And you know what? The only personal thing is that somebody sat down, poured their heart on the page, tried to write the best book they could, and they did not set out to deliberately irk anybody. They set out to do, it's their baby. And you're right, maybe it's not the book for you, but it may like change the world for somebody else. And we have to honor that.
Yeah. Before we discuss this book, so for our listeners today, we're going to be discussing Days of Wonder, and I will read you the flap copy. Before we get there, Caroline, this is your 13th novel. I mean, you know, publishing is tough. It's a tough industry. So many authors struggle to publish a debut. Tons go on to never get to publish a second book or a third book. So what is your key to this kind of longevity and success? Do you keep pivoting, reinventing yourself? What's your advice?
My advice is never give up. You know what? Just never give up, because you never know what's going to happen. My career has actually been like a lot of ups and downs. My very first novel was, you know, I was very lucky. I got published instantly and I had a lot of acclaim and I was really young. I was in my early 20s. And I thought, oh, it's always going to be like this. And of course it's not. It's not. So I, you know, my next book was also did well. Then my third to my eighth book, like, did not do so well. And I was bouncing around publishers thinking, what am I going to do? I was making no money and I was always worried. So for my ninth novel, was on contract with a publisher and they called me up and they said, we're not going to publish it. We don't think it's special enough. And I started crying and I said, well, what can I do to make it special enough? And they said, we don't think you can do anything. And I said, well, would you look at another book of mine? And they said, no, you know, best of luck in the future. So I hung up the phone. I was near hysterical, because if you have nine books and you have no sales and nobody really knows who you are, your career is over. And my agent said, no, 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 don't worry, don't worry. That's where the writer's community comes in. I called all my friends sobbing, saying, I'm so ashamed. I feel terrible. I'm never going to get anywhere. And one of my friends said, look, I just was signed by Algonquin. I have a new editor there. Her name is Andre Miller. And I think she might like this. Can I tell her about you? And I said, yes, please. So she told Andra, and I got a call from Andra, and she was just sort of talking to me about how Algonquin works. And I said, look, I have to be honest with you. I can't lie. I said, no, I work really hard at my work, but my books don't sell. And she laughed and she said, oh, it's going to sell. It's going to sell. Don't worry. So they took the book, really low advance, which was fine. And they got it into six printings 6 months before the book came out. The week it came out, it was a New York Times bestseller. And in fact, the editor who had told me, you know, no, we're not going to, you know, it's not special, called my agent and said, would Caroline like to come back to us? And my agent said, no. And, you know, by that time, that book Pictures View was huge, huge success. But at that time, I knew already that that doesn't mean the next book will. You know what? You have to like stay very focused and just really put your heart in your book. And some wonderful books won't get attention. Some books will. And I just persist. I just tell myself, you know what? I'm going to write the books that I love and see what happens. And if you're depending on being famous or, you know, making a lot of money, you're in the wrong profession. You should do it for love. You should do it for love. And that's what I do.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what we have control of as authors is writing the best damn book we can. That's all we can control. The rest, marketing, PR, sometimes the book flies completely under the radar. Sometimes through pure luck, you tap into something that everybody happens to be talking about and suddenly it gets picked up by everybody. But all of that's beyond your control. So it's bum in the chair, communing with your characters and just paying, you know, them tribute and doing the story justice.
That's right. And I also want to tell like any writer out there that don't take rejections to heart too much because you don't know what's going on. You don't know if a publisher has a certain kind of list that they want. Maybe they had a book was like yours. Maybe the editor who's reading your book is afraid of losing her job, so she's looking for something very commercial. Or maybe she's leaving. She's about to quit. All you can do is just, you know, look at it and see if there's anything that makes sense to you. And if there isn't, just move on. Just move on. It's one person's opinion. It's just one person's opinion.
And that's why on our Books with Hooks segment, in which we look at writers' query letters and the opening pages, we have two agents who do that, and they often disagree. We're so happy when they do disagree because it does show how very subjective this is. Our one agent will be like, this opening work, it's full of suspense and tension, and I love it. And the other agent is like, didn't work for me. I would have passed on this. So it is important to know how subjective it is.
It's absolutely important. And you can't also never write to the market.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like never write to the market because, first of all, what makes your book unique is you. And second of all, whatever's popular in the market now, it takes like a year or 2 years or sometimes even three for a book to be published. Whatever's popular now may not be popular in 3 years. And why copy somebody else when you have something unique? So I tell people when you're writing your first draft, don't even think of your readers. Just get your, you know, it's like opening up your chest, opening up your heart, get that on the page. You can worry about all that stuff later, if at all.
And the market changes so quickly. So I remember a little while ago, we were talking about how vampire books were over. I think 3 years, we were saying it's very difficult to sell a vampire or a werewolf book. That's run its course. And then now recently, Ali Hazelwood, who is New York Times bestselling rom-com, wrote about werewolves and vampires, and suddenly they're back in again. So for those people who were loving their vampires, had they just been writing them and not given up on them, you know, they would have had these books ready to go. So I 100% agree with you there. Okay, so for our listeners, I'm just going to read the flap copy to you now for Days of Wonder so I can put the next bunch of questions in context. As a teenager, for a moment, Ella Fitchburg found love. Yearning, breathless love that consumed both her and her boyfriend Jude as they wandered the streets of New York City together. But her life was unexpectedly upended when she was accused of trying to murder Jude's father, an imperious superior court judge, and sentenced to 25 years in prison. When she learns she's pregnant shortly after sentencing, she reluctantly decides to give up the child. After Ella is released from prison, she's desperate to turn the page on a new life, but she cannot seem to let go of her past. With only an address as a possible lead, she moves to Ann Arbor, Michigan, determined to get her daughter back. Hiding her identity, living in a constant state of deception, she finds that what she's been searching for all along is a way to uncover and live with the truth. Yet a central mystery endures. Neither Jude nor Ella can remember the events leading up to the attempted murder, that fateful night which led to Ella's conviction. For fans of Miranda Cowley Heller's The Paper Palace and Allegra Goodman's Sam, Caroline Levitt's Days of Wonder is a gripping, high-drama page-turner about the elusive nature of redemption and the profound reach of love. Dun, dun, dun. So much there. And can I just say, Caroline, your blurbs from these authors, like, made me salivate. The blurbs you got, if I could have gotten one blurb from one of these authors, I would have done a happy dance. This was just incredible.
This is why the writer community is so wonderful. I mean, they all came, a lot of these people came out to help. And a lot of people that who I, you know, some of them I knew vaguely. Other of them, they knew of A Mighty Blaze and they were so happy to help. And I was always really honest. You know, when I asked for blurbs, I said, look, I know it's a terrible thing to have to ask for blurbs. Everybody hates it. A lot of writers hate giving blurbs because it takes up your time. And sometimes they don't use your blurb. And then you feel like, why not? And I just said, look, I would be so grateful if you would just, you know, read this. And, you know, some of them could not or did not. And there's always people who like, they don't like the book, but a lot of people responded and it was incredible. I was so, so grateful. So, so grateful.
And if you don't ask, you'll never know, right? Worst case scenario, you get a no, right? Well, I'm busy.
That's the wonder of email. You should always, always email and always start up at the top because if they're not interested, they just won't answer. In fact, the best piece of advice I ever got from a writer was from Carolyn C., who was a wonderful writer and a wonderful critic. And she told me that every month, even twice a month, write a lovely note. You can make it handwritten if you want, or you can do it on Twitter. Just telling a writer you love that you love their work. Don't ask for anything. Just say, you know what? Your work has meant so much to me. First of all, you're putting out so much good energy out there. Second of all, writers love it. And I started to do that. And to my surprise, I got responses from people. I wrote a letter to John Irving, and he sent me a 2-page handwritten response because he said he read my letter twice and I wasn't asking for anything. And he said, that's amazing. You were not asking for anything. So I'm going to write you back. That's how you build community. It's just a wonderful thing to do. And everybody should do it. Even if you go on Twitter and say, oh, I loved your last book. It was wonderful. The writer's going to see it. And they're going to love it, and they're going to love you, and you've done good.
Yeah, I'm at the process now where I'm asking for blurbs, and I begin every subject line is that cringy, awkward blurb request, so that before they even open the email, they know what's coming.
I'll give you a blurb.
Oh, thank you. You're an angel, Caroline. And yeah, I met John Irving once. And I was so intimidated that when my agent tried to introduce me to John Irving, I was just like, oh my God, I can't speak to him. And I just ran and hid in the corner with my glass of wine the whole night and kind of stared at him in wonder. So that was a missed opportunity.
Don't be intimidated. He's actually an incredibly kind person. I mean, after he wrote the letter, I actually did ask him for something. I said, can I interview you on A Mighty Blaze? And he said, yeah. And it was incredible. I mean, he was so generous and so kind. And again, you never know until you ask, what's the worst thing that can happen? Nobody has ever yelled at me, which was always my big fear, you know, but nobody has ever yelled at me.
Yeah. Well, I think he lives in Toronto. I think he doesn't live far from me. So, and I know his favorite restaurant. So maybe I'll start stalking him.
You should. You definitely should. He's very kind.
Okay. So you said in the acknowledgements that you love doing research. And I love that you also said you spoke to a lawyer who was your first husband to help you with research. So can you tell us a bit about how your research process looks?
Yeah, I had to do a lot of research, especially about the legal system. And I began like just calling regular lawyers. And the thing was that they weren't writers. So they would say, well, this would never happen. And lawyers are good. I kept saying, no, you don't understand. I want a lawyer who's not so good. And then they would sort of clam up. So my first husband was an attorney, and we actually stayed friends after the divorce, which was like really a terrible divorce, but we became friends again. And he's actually my second husband and I's lawyer now. So I called him up and said, Greg, you know, I need a lawyer in a police situation where they screw up. And he said, oh, I can give you that. And he gave me all the information I needed to my plot, but he was in Florida. So he said, well, you better check with like a New York criminal defense attorney. So I was looking around and someone said, oh, you should meet my friend Peter Barta. He's great. He's a defense attorney. He's funny. He's smart. So I emailed him and he said, yeah, let's get on Zoom. And we got on Zoom and he was so great. And he said, okay, I'm going to give you a list of movies to see that'll show you exactly how the system works. He invited me to come to court with him, and he just talked to me for hours, and he was incredible, and now we're friends. That's how I got that information. But I had to do a whole lot of research. I had to talk to women who had been in prison, who were out of prison, what their experiences were. And I went into the Hasidic community in New York, and I talked to people who had left that community, because people who were in the community wouldn't talk to me. They were very polite, but they did not want to talk to me.
And as you said in your research as well, Hasidic and Orthodox is different.
It's different.
Right. And it's those nuances that are so, so important, right?
That's right. That's right. My mom, a lot of the story started out with my mom. My mom grew up in an Orthodox Jewish home. Her father was a rabbi, and it was very restrictive, but not like the Hasidic community, which is even more insulated. My mother could go out in the community. If you're raised in a Hasidic community, you're not supposed to. You're told it's very, very dangerous, that they want to hurt you, that you should stay in your community and stay in your place. And it's especially not welcoming for women and not positive for women. But the interesting thing is I had long interviews with four different people, including one man who was in that community. And I asked them all, like, well, you know, they were telling me these terrible stories. They lost their kids. The guy was, when he tried to go back and see his kids, he was beaten up. It was a violent sect and terrible, terrible things. And I asked him, is there anything you all miss? And they all said the same thing, which was, you know, it was so lovely when it was good, when they were children, to have this sense of community where they felt totally adored, totally loved, everything was protected, and they missed that. And they were yearning for that. And I thought, oh, that's something I can really dig into as a writer, because that's something everybody wants. You know, everybody wants to feel loved and protected.
Yeah, it's that personal universal element. You know, when fiction has that personal universal element, something that everybody wants, regardless of their age, their sexual orientation, religious beliefs, like that is all anybody wants. And when you're able to sort of tap into that in a novel, that immediately makes your readers connect with your characters, with what it is you're trying to do.
That's exactly right. And that's like, no matter what you're writing, if you find the thing that haunts you personally, like I always felt like an outsider and I always yearned for that kind of community, then it makes what you're writing real. And it's with anything. Same thing with talking to the lawyers. I always was afraid of, I don't know why, but I was just afraid of, you know, being yelled at by a cop or being arrested, or what would I do or how would I? It's that thing that you work with and that you write about. And that's what makes the research so compelling.
Well, this was my worst fear come true. I think since a child, I've been terrified that I would be arrested and go to prison for something, you know, either that I did it accidentally or that I didn't do it. So, you know, this was like high emotion, high drama for me, because I was like, oh my God, this is my worst fear. And you start from that place, you know, which is really draws the reader in, because I think tons of readers are like, oh my God, this could happen to anybody, really.
It can happen to anybody. That's why they have the Innocence Project, because there are so many people who did not do it, or they had bad lawyers or whatever. And
listen, there's some communities where you're much more likely for this to happen to you in terms of racial profiling, etc. But yeah, it could happen to anybody. And so I really, really felt for her. Can we talk a bit about two more things? And there's so much to unpack here, but I'm focusing on the things that I know our listeners love to hear about. One is you chose the time period of 2018, 2019. And then, of course, there were flashbacks. Did you do that to try and avoid COVID? Or was there very specific reasons for 2018, 2019?
Yeah, I did that because COVID and the pandemic were such a huge thing that as soon as you introduce it, that's what the book is about, you know? And I just thought, I had like so much going on. I thought, plus I didn't want to write about it. It felt like it was too soon for me to think about. And even now, I don't want to write about COVID. So I set it close enough so it would be modern and yet so I could avoid doing that. And that's the only reason. I just didn't want to write about it.
No, I loved it. And it worked. The setting and the time. I mean, this is the kind of story that could have happened really at any time. And you grounded us in that time period, which was wonderful. But yeah, I kind of suspected that. In terms of setting, this is another thing that comes up so often, is that people feel like they have to write about New York or Chicago or big name cities or big places. Now, some of it takes place in Brooklyn and then some of it in Ann Arbor. Now, shout out to Literati, which is one of my favorite independent bookstores.
Yeah, they're great.
It's amazing. So why Ann Arbor?
Well, because when I was thinking about where to go to college, I thought, well, I have to stay on the East Coast. And I went to Brandeis and I began to feel like this is too insulated. I need to get out there. And I went to visit a friend of mine who was going out to college in Ann Arbor. And I had never been there. And as soon as I got there, I was like, this whole world cracked open, because Ann Arbor is a college town, but it's so culturally busy. I mean, and there were so many interesting people and it felt like so full of possibility. It felt like to me like a place where I could go and reinvent myself. So I quickly transferred from Brandeis to Ann Arbor. And the day I got there, I just thought, this is the place for me. This is where I belong. And I stayed there like well past graduation. I got a job at a little bookstore there. And I just stayed and stayed and stayed because I just loved it. It was the perfect place and the perfect time. And I was the perfect age because there were a lot of young people there. And so when I was thinking of a place for Ella to go to, I wanted her to have a place which would also feel like, oh my God, this is my place. And I thought, well, yeah, of course I'm going to set it in Ann Arbor. And I still have friends there. So I called up my friends there and said, okay, you have to tell me of like what's changed. And I rolled off all the places that I had loved when I was there. And some of them were there, some of them were not there. And I made sure all my pages were vetted. And I got to sort of revisit Ann Arbor in the most lovely way. I mean, I still love the town. I think it's like a magic town. The only bad thing I can say about it is very cold in the winter.
I live in Toronto, so...
Oh, like, yeah.
That's nothing. We can handle
it's
that.
It's nothing, yeah.
But it was great to see a smaller town that doesn't get featured a lot, you know, in this book. And you had the big Brooklyn kind of city stuff to balance that out. And that was really wonderful. In terms of your characterization, Caroline, loved Ella, but especially loved Helen, you know. And we're talking about a person who's just so amazing, so incredible, but also flawed. Also vulnerable, someone who makes mistakes. And so how do you approach characterization when you sit down to say, okay, I need to form a Helen? Do you think about people you know? Do you put some of yourself into her? Do you create her from scratch?
I do a little bit of all of it. I mean, Helen started out like my mom, and I had sort of a complicated relationship with my mom where she wanted us to be like sisters. And I fought against that a lot because I wanted a mom, not a sister. And then as I got older, I started writing the book, I started to realize, well, why did she want that? Why was it important to her? And then I created Helen's history, which was, well, because she had no family, you know, that's what she wanted. She wanted a feeling of, you know, it's us against the world. And I do a lot of structural work with characters. I try to figure out, well, what do they want? And what's their misconception about it? And as soon as I thought about the misconception, I thought, well, Helen's misconception was that she thought that by being so close to her daughter, it would be good for both of them. But it actually wasn't. And even when she started to see that it wasn't so good to be that close and even controlling, she couldn't stop herself. She sort of had to happen to make her realize, oh no, I lost this. And then she had to figure out, well, what is going to replace it? How do you have a good relationship? It takes a long time. I do like 18 revisions and I do like 6 months of character work. So it takes a whole lot of time, which is what I always tell like writers I work with or writers I know, that you have to love revision, you know, because things come up afterwards. Don't rush, take your time, and it'll come when you want it to come.
That is where the magic happens. It's in the rewrites. Something that I've learned on the podcast is I always used to think genre was pretty clear cut. And genre is something that most of our listeners struggle with, because when they submit their query letters to us with their opening pages, often we'll say, you pitching this as this, but we don't think that's the right genre. So when it comes to a book like this, and we can go off for days about how we feel about women's fiction as a category, it pisses us off chronically. But like, how would you classify this particular book?
Well, first of all, genre is, everybody should understand that genre is a marketing decision. It's mostly for the salespeople because they're going into a bookstore saying, what section sells the best? And if a bookstore says, mysteries do, then they're going to want to know to all the books that are pitched as mysteries. I have so many stories of writers who thought they were writing YA and then it turned out it was like adult fiction. I never know how to categorize myself. I've been categorized as literary fiction. I've gotten that horrible label, women's fiction. And the only reason why I hate that is because it's demeaning in a way. That, you know, if a man wrote, I always say like, well, if Jonathan Franzen wrote, you know, a so-called women's fiction, he'd still be called a genius, you know?
Yeah, well, I think Wally Lamb wrote She's Come Undone, right?
Yeah, if a woman wrote it, women's fiction.
Women's fiction. But Wally Lamb, then it wasn't women's fiction, even though it was a woman character dealing with women's issues, right? Yeah.
Yep. There's a new category now that's being bandied around called upmarket, which means something's literary and yet it's also commercial. And I always tell writers, you know what, just call it upmarket fiction, because then they'll think, oh, it'll sell, and yet it's also sort of literary and it'll have good stuff. I never pay attention to that kind of stuff myself because I know it's a marketing decision. And the thing is, if you want your book to sell, don't get too hung up on what they tell you it is, because the idea is to get it in the bookstore, to have people reading and talking about it and saying, look, I know, you think it's YA, but it's not. It's really great. And then more people will talk about it. So I try not to pay too much attention to that. And I tell people not to pay attention to it either.
Yeah, I think the only time it's important for our listeners is when they're trying to get an agent and agents put on their manuscript wish list. I am looking for this or that or psychological thriller or whatever. And then it's important that you're pitching your book to the right person.
Right. Well, what I would do is you can also do hybrids now. There are a lot of writers who do write. So I would always say, you know what? Look for the agent who has books that you think are like yours. And if it says they're looking for psychological fiction and you think yours is kind of YA, pitch it as my book is psychological YA. Like, let them decide. The idea is you want to sort of slide your foot in the door.
Yeah, excellent advice. And for our listeners, remember again what I call jazz hands writing, which is, look, Ma, I'm writing with all the over-the-top metaphors and stuff. That is not literary fiction. So don't think that overwriting means literary fiction.
No. Literary fiction is character-driven. It's really character-driven. A lot of it is language, but there's also a kind of literary fiction that is plotless, that is based on language. So, I mean, you can make your head explode when you think of genres. So, again, my advice is just write the book you're dying to read.
Excellent, excellent advice, Caroline. We will end there. Thank you so much. For our listeners, we're linking to our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy the book from there, you will support an independent bookstore and the podcast. We hope to have you back again, Caroline. Thank you.
I'd love to. Thank you so much. I had such a great time.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Calling all memoirists. I'm so excited to let you know that I've put together an incredible all about memoir lineup for Saturday, the 11th of May from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, in which 6 amazing speakers guide you through everything you need to know to write a memoir that will sell. You'll get opportunities to ask questions of best-selling memoirists while also standing a chance to have your query letter live critiqued during the webinar. To see the awesome lineup and to register, go to biancamurray.com. There's an early bird promotion for the first 50 delegates who sign up. Come and join us and get your memoir groove on.